This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Media Splode, episode 17.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, home. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock. Till broad daylight. We're gonna rock, gonna rock around the clock tonight.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Media Splode, episode 17. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hey there.
And Ron Richards.
Hey, how's it going?
And Media Splode is the show unlocked by the patrons over at patreon.com/ifanboy. It's our monthly non-comics media show in which we talk about the things we're doing outside of the world of comics, which is a lot. We are multifaceted with multi-interests.
We are not one thing.
And so we like to start the show off by talking about what it is we've been watching or listening to or whatever in the past month since we last talked. Ron, why don't you start us off?
All right. So I've got a couple of things I want to talk about. One is a negative, one is a positive. Oh, but I feel like
exciting. Before
I do any of that, I think we should acknowledge something that all three of us should be listening to, which is the return of one of our favorite podcasts.
That is true. Mates is back. Mike and Tom Eat Snacks.
They are back. Tom Cavanaugh
is back, or are they just back for one?
They're back. Have you listened to it yet?
Or? No, not yet.
As far as I understand, they're back. They're on a new podcast network. They're on the Starburns network. So I think they're back. They've got new album art. So I think they're going for it.
Tom's off Flash, so he's got time now.
Yeah, exactly. The new episode is Pistachios. And I will say and they talk about that. They discuss that. But it was a good episode. It was like old times. It was like returning to a comforting time in your life built around food and lots of Tom Cavanaugh yelling.
All right.
In the good way. So all you mateys out there, ratings, stormtroopers, everything, ratings. I do like that they've kept the same format. You know, of course, it's the PERS system, right? Yep. Pick a snack, eat a snack, rate a snack.
Yep.
But I like how they get into ratings and then they do the last rating and they're like, see you next week. And that's it. Like yeah, there's no banter at the end. It's just done once they've rated. So I listened to that while mowing the lawn today. So I was glad that Mates is back. That's number one. So what do you want? Do you want the negative review or the positive review?
Negative.
Negative.
Then positive.
This is going to shock you. Are both of you sitting down?
Yes.
I'm here.
So Disney Plus came out with a docuseries called Behind the Attraction.
Uh-oh.
And it's produced by the people who do the movies that make us and the toys that made us at Netflix.
Yeah.
I was so excited for this because as you guys know, I'm a big Disney Parks fan. They've released five episodes.
Like those docs.
And I love those docs. I think they're great. I don't know if they're docuseries or reality show or like whatever it is. Yeah, like, you know. And what I found out is that my attitude for the history of Disney Parks does not align with the tongue-in-cheek, fast editing, zinger-laden, out-of-context quotes format of that show.
So when it's something you really care about, you get pissed.
Exactly. Which is funny.
It's not enough of the romance. That's a big part of it for you.
They just came out with the new movies that made us, and there's, I think there's Back to the Future. They're like, there's a whole, and I'm like, I can't wait to watch them. And I was like, why is it? It's the same approach. It's the same where like someone says something funny, and they just keep showing it at every point out of context, but like to drive the repetitive joke, like that sort of thing. But for some reason, it's just like we watched the first one, and I was like, oh, this isn't good. Oh no. Watch the rest of them. They did get better. The first episode was particularly bad, but they did get a little better. Uh-huh. Part of it is that I know a lot of the history that they're talking about. And so like I kind of was, well, actually it wasn't like that, you know, like it was kind
of, oh yeah, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, exactly. But I know that with the movie stuff too. So I it's fascinating to see why the same format applied to a different subject matter could make me feel so radically different.
Hmm.
But that said, they just announced the next five that they're going to release, and I'll watch them. I'll still watch them because I still want to see it. But I was shocked that I did not love it. Like, if you're into this stuff, and if you're listening, you probably watched The Imagineering Story on Disney Plus. That came out right when Disney Plus came out. It was a documentary about Imagineering. That was much more – it had reverence. It had respect. Like, this felt like it didn't have respect for the subject
matter. No respect.
No respect. So that's something I watched I was excited about that I was disappointed by. But I will. The thing I was excited to find was a whole bunch of my friends or people I know in the music scene were talking about a documentary called At the Matinee, which was a documentary about the New York hardcore scene around CBGBs in the 80s, where they used to have these Sunday matinees. You know, a show would start at like 3 o'clock and four or five bands would play and, you know, it'd be cheap to get into. And it became like the scene, like everyone went to the shows and like that's where, you know, Warzone and Gorilla Biscuits and Youth of Today and Bold and all those bands of those era kind of went and played. It was a really, really well done documentary. Had everybody that needed to talk to was talked to. Had a lot of great archival photos and footage of like that time period of the 80s and old shots of CBGBs and the Bowery back in the day. But Josh, where I found this was because like everyone was talking about the documentary and I went to go watch it. It wasn't streaming anywhere. The only place it's streaming was on an app that I've never heard of, which now I've added. They have a Google TV app, so I added it to my TV. It's called Quello, Q-E-L-L-O. It's actually called Quello Concerts, and it is just a live concert streaming service.
Oh, my God.
So it's $11.99, $12 a month, right? So you got to really be into it. But they have every music documentary you can think of, and then they have all these live music performances. But like when you go to the website, and go look at it. There's a lot of like, you know, Paul McCartney and Red Hot Chili Peppers and Led Zeppelin, like stuff you'd exist. But like I, you know, search for it. You know, I'm searching right now. I'm gonna search for you, Josh. I'll do Dinosaur Jr. Mm-hmm. And there are Dinosaur Jr. playing Bug live at the 9:30 Club.
I have and that on vinyl.
Dinosaur Jr. in Berlin live. There's a Jay Masix said live at Spettelgen Festival. Like there's multiple of many of the bands that we all like. And I was like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. So
Do you know about YouTube?
Yes.
Because it turns out there are quite a lot of well shot live shows there, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. But I just thought it was interesting. It was a nice discovery.
It is interesting.
I'm going to cancel it after the month I watched the documentary. I wanted to see. I'm going to cancel it. But for now, I'm like, well, I paid. Let me just see what's in there. You know?
Oh, so, yeah. No, I totally get that.
It was just neat. So I thought anybody who's into music might want to check out Quello Concerts. That's where I watched live at the matinee from. So
there was definitely a real point where I realized, like, I was like, I'd like to see this band live. And you just search on YouTube and like, oh, every band has 100 shows and they're not like shitty cell phones. You're like, they're just there and it's the best.
Yeah.
Before we move on, I'm going to throw in a curveball this month.
Oh, wow.
Ron, are you reading anything right now?
Well, you know, I finally finished The Big Goodbye, which is a book that you got me for Christmas, which is basically about the making of Chinatown.
Right.
That's the most recent thing I've read, and I haven't decided what I'm going to read next.
So you just finished that?
I just finished it, correct.
All right. Good job.
Thanks.
So since we last talked, I had been mostly watching the Olympics. So when the Olympics is on, I basically don't watch anything else unless it's very important. Ted Lasso or The Good Fight or whatever. But everything else sort of falls by the wayside while the Olympics are on for the 2 weeks. So that took up the 2 out of the 4 weeks since we last spoke. But there was a show I took a flyer on and ended up enjoying on HBO called Small Town News KPVM Pahrump.
Oh, wow.
I'd seen these billboards around town. I was like, what the fuck is that? It was a 6-part documentary series, 30 minutes each, about this independently owned news station in Pahrump, Nevada, KPVM, They're not a broadcast station. They're a digital station. So like 25.3, whatever. If, I don't remember. Ron, you used to have a HD antenna. So you'd get the digital channels. I used to have that in New York.
Yeah, with HD over the air, you have point channels. So there would be, you know, channel 25.1, 0.2, 0.3, and there'd be different channels at the points too.
So this is 25.3 or whatever, something like that. And it was enjoyable on a lot of levels. One, you know, the three of us studied television making in college, and it felt very much like that, you know. It's these wacky people making TV in the desert in Nevada on this channel that probably not a lot of people are watching. And, you know, in our college station, we had a TV studio that we made TV on that the whole town could watch. You know, our station went out to the whole town. And so it felt very much like that atmosphere of we're just going to do whatever we need to do to make this work. And it was very interesting because it happened during the election. And the owner of the station's like super Trump supporter, and the news manager is a Democrat. And so there was a lot of interesting stuff going on there. It was just a very kind of goofy look at these five or six people running this small channel that's apparently self-sufficient in the middle of the desert in Pahrump, Nevada, trying to make the news work. People come and go because they can't afford salaries. And
it's hard.
It was funny, though. Like, it was interesting and you kind of, it was endearing and you really wanted them to succeed. One of the big storylines is they get a new signal booster so they can get picked up in Las Vegas. So that's like a big deal for them. And so, you know, they're expanding their market. It was really fascinating. It was 30 minutes. You could knock it out. And it was just like these kind of goofy middle-aged people running a TV station.
Cool. I never even heard of this.
I hadn't heard of it other than seeing a billboard on one of my drives around town. It's called Small Town News, KPV in Pahrump. It's going to be on HBO Max if you're at all interested in sort of the behind the scenes of TV making. And it felt very much like our time in college, just making TV is the best way you can. And I'm reading right now, I'm about halfway through The Good Shepherd, written by C.S. Forrester. This is the novel that the Tom Hanks movie Greyhound was based on.
Oh.
And I picked that up recently. It's not that long, like 250 pages. And I was like, oh, I should check that out. It's basically much like the movie in that it's like unrelenting Navy tactics. Very, very, very tactical. And there's no like no chapter breaks. And it just, so he's got it broken up by
shifts. It's just shift. The ship's log.
It's the shifts. So it's like day shift, mid shift, night shift.
Right.
But the shifts go like for 50 pages. So I'm just like, come on, man. Give me a break in the story here. I got to go to bed. If you're all interested, I think Josh, you might like it. It's very like tactical, you know, why they move the ship a certain way and depth charge battles and tactics with that. And it just jumps you right in. It's just, I'm stressed out reading because it's like U-boats. I'm enjoying that book quite a bit right now. Josh? What are you doing? What are you watching?
I feel like I should talk about books a little bit.
Books after at the end. What have you been watching?
Let's see. The thing I was, I guess I talked about this a little in our hangout because I was like, what was the other thing I was going to talk about? And it was that I went to a live comedy show, right. Which you guys know. I went and saw John Mulaney in Boston at the Wilbur. He's doing a very long stand there. And we bought tickets a while ago. And as we got closer, it was like, should we go do this thing? But we did. We put our masks on and we went. And it was weird at first because you're sitting there and you're waiting for this thing to start and you're like, all right, get on with it. I don't want to sit here. But sort of when it starts, you feel normal, which is the same thing has happened a couple of times that I've been to the movies.
Right.
But there is a point in live comedy about an hour in where you're like, all right, wrap it up. Because you can't laugh for that long. You know, he's really funny and it was incredibly earnest and he's not skipping around the details or the story of his last year and change, and it's very honest.
It's been dramatic. He's had a year, that's for sure.
Yeah, and he doesn't sidestep any of that at all. He doesn't talk about his marriage. He didn't talk any of that stuff, but he talked about, you know, his addiction. He talks about being a junkie. He talks about having an intervention, and it was really funny. And then the last, like, 25% was a little more straight-up stand-up, where he was just talking about, like, things that make him a bad person. He goes like, I know we're supposed to believe science and I think we should get the vaccines and all that, but if you put a gun to my head right now and ask me if the world was flat, I don't know. It was like, you're telling me that they went and they found a dinosaur bone and they managed to put the whole skeleton together. If Wayfair sent you a crate and you had to put your credenza together without instructions, you couldn't do it. It was funny. But, yeah, he certainly hasn't lost a step in that way at all. And, you know, as I saw Aziz Ansari's show after he came back from his thing, which was a much more low-key affair than Mulaney's, but I've seen a couple of these now where like they have to deal with the stuff that's happened to them outside of the stage. And it was impressive. It was, you know, it was Richard Pryor lighting himself on fire. It was Dignitaro, I have cancer, and you just hope he's going to be okay and be able to maintain because he's just a crazy talent. So that was fun. I'm glad I did it. I wouldn't buy tickets to do it again, but since I already had the tickets and I was like, this is this isn't going to happen a lot. Mm-hmm. Me and my wife are really big fans of his. The other thing I wanted to mention is I had to get a trial of Cinemax so that I could watch the movie that we are going to talk about later.
You mean Skinemax?
I guess.
You know, it was $3 on Apple.
That's what we used to call it on
high school. It was free dollars on my Apple TV to just say, yes, turn this on. So free is less than three.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure how long it was going to take me to watch it, and I didn't want to run out of the 24 hours or whatever I had. So anyway, whatever. I was looking at Cinemax, like, well, what's on here? And I was like, ooh, late night. No, I didn't do that. Because Showtime also has a late night section, by the way. And also, there's this thing on the internet called porn, and that makes that stuff completely useless.
Wow, all right.
Anyway, I was looking at sort of the stuff on Cinemax, and I saw Mike Judge's Tales from the Tour Bus. And I thought, oh, I had heard about this. And it's Mike Judge of, you know, Beavis and Butthead and Silicon Valley and King of the Hill and all that. And he produces and narrates this show about tales of mostly country, but also some rock folks. He gets all the people's friends together and tells, you know, the stories of that artist. So the first one was Johnny Paycheck, the guy who did mm-hmm. Take This Job and Shove It.
Yep.
And how incredibly, like, he was a criminal. he was a real piece of shit. And you have like all the guys in his band are interviewed first person, and the first person narration and stuff is all animated, like over top of the images. So it's like Mike Judge looking animation, but the documentary footage and pictures and stuff are real, and it's all first person accounts. And then Mike Judge sort of narrates a little. When he speaks, it's funny. Even if he's not trying to be, it's kind of impossible not to be, you know. And then they did two parts on George Jones, and there was one on Jerry Lee Lewis. There's two full seasons of it. And at the very end, they sort of peel away the animation and you can see the people who are there talking. I mean, but the stories are insane. You know, these Nashville guys from the 60s and 70s, holy shit.
Yeah.
You know, and the Jerry Lee Lewis stories, they're crazy. And it's just a great, great show where like this one guy who has power in Hollywood is like, I'd like to do a show like this. And they do it. And because it's on Cinemax, probably no one will ever see it. But it was delightful. It was such a fun thing to discover and be able to watch. So I will probably pay for the rest of Cinemax for a month so I can finish them because there's two seasons.
Wow.
Nice.
That and watch the nudie shows.
Sure.
Do they still have the nudie shows? Is it still valid in terms of a term?
Let's see.
The problem is that the association with the name is so strong in that direction.
Yeah.
There's just no getting around it. I hear Cinemax and I think of late night movies. No other association with it.
That's kind of the thing. But, you know, the fact is, like, they all, you know, HBO had them, and they actually got rid of them at a certain point.
Right, but the thing is, they were known for it. The branding is a problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you reading right now, Josh?
Cinemax. I'm sort of in between my comics bouts. I'm reading through Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas by Glenn Kenny.
Mm-hmm. That might be the next one I read. I haven't read that.
Well, you know, like I am reading, I wish this was out in 2016.
Yeah. Make things a little easier. Are we referenced at all in that book?
Not so far.
It's a shame.
It's good. It's not like amazing, and we know bits of it, but it's fun and it's good to go back and reference this stuff. And like, there's not a ton in here that I'm like, I can't believe that. There is stuff that I have forgotten.
Does it make you want to go back and watch it again?
I mean, that doesn't take a lot. It's a little more.
We should mention that for people who don't know, we did a podcast about Goodfellas.
Yes.
4 years ago, called Goodfellas Minute. So check that out on the internet if you're curious.
So, the thing is, it's called Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas. In my mind, that meant it was about the making of Goodfellas. And it is to a certain extent.
What's it about? Because I have it on my to-read show stack, too.
It's the whole story of everything. Like, you know, sort of like what we did.
It's just Wise Guy by Nicholas Pileggi. Yeah.
No, I mean, like,
you take the cover off and by underneath it says Wise Guy
story, and you know, and you know, Scorsese's relationship with Ileana Douglas and how she, you know, like it's all sort of, you know, what De Niro was like, what the things that he'd get mad about.
Is Scorsese's mother in there?
She will. I'm not that far. I've been burning through audiobooks because my dog's been walking a lot lately, and I did the newest Andy Weir book. Mm-hmm. Operation Hail Mary, which I think, Connor, you read.
I just finished it, yeah.
How was that?
It's fucking great. I loved it.
It's much better than the disaster that the second book was.
Yes.
He very consciously returns to The Martian.
Yeah, it's the thing that he does, but it's a different story, and it's pretty goddamn imaginative, and it really turns into a really great buddy story, I thought. I loved it, and I'm listening to Chrissy Hynde's memoir as read by the, you know, from Pulp Fiction, the one with all the shit in her face? She narrates it. No, but it's like her story is nuts, and she was there in like the 70s, you know, in Britain for the punk coming up through there, and oof. It's a hell of a, you know why I started listening to it is because I was listening to Jason Narducci on Turned Out a Punk, and he's like, she has the craziest rock story I've ever heard. And so I immediately was like, oh, I'll check that out. It's worth it.
Cool. All right. So that's what we've been enjoying. And so one of the things we've been talking about amongst ourselves we wanted to do is the classic film segment. We've been mentioning amongst ourselves films we could review going into the past and looking back on.
Don't we have a name for this?
We do have a name for it. So we decided it's Old Men on Old Movies. That's what we are. That's what they are. And so Ron suggested we kick it off with American Graffiti from 1973, written and directed by George Lucas, co-written by Gloria Katz and Willard Hayuk, and produced by Francis Ford Coppola.
And Kurtz.
Captain Kurtz.
Gary Kurtz is producer on it.
And think perhaps most importantly, Walter Murch on sound design.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I'm not even kidding. Yeah.
This is only film that George Lucas directed that wasn't sci-fi.
Yeah.
Important in many ways, pop culturally, which we'll get into. Ron, since you suggested it, why don't you take off this discussion?
So the context, at least why I recommended American Graffiti, was that my niece is leaving for college next week, in fact.
Nope.
Yeah, no, unfortunately she is. We can't deny this.
She's going
into
third grade.
Yeah. I know, barely in the third grade. And so a couple of months ago, my dad had sat down.
Son's going into second grade.
Nope.
My younger one.
Nope. A couple of months ago, my dad sat down and made her watch Citizen Kane because it was like, you got to see these movies before you go to college, whatever. And I was like, Citizen Kane is great, but like, she liked it. I'm like, Citizen Kane is great, but I'm like, you got to see American Graffiti. And it actually reminded me because I remembered the night of my senior prom. Me and my friends, we just stayed out all night, right? Like, I remember getting home at like 6 a.m.
Yep.
And my dad laughing and going, I hope you enjoyed your American Graffiti night, right? And like, it's that idea of American Graffiti really created the genre of the coming of age, high school age, one night story, a night in the life of a group of friends, you know, usually around graduation or going to college or like the end of this sort of thing. And it defined that genre. And in addition to defining that genre, being such big fans of Star Wars and basically of George Lucas's work, like it's safe to say that George Lucas is one of the most important creators to me as well as to you guys in terms of, you know, forming my thing. And the fact that everything that we've read about him through the Rinzler books, may he rest in peace. That's sad. That was a sad passing. But through all the makings of Star Wars and everything, as stiff as, you know, faster, more intense and as bad as The Phantom Menace was and all stuff like that, to believe that the same guy who made those movies made this incredibly personal,
small,
emotional, small film. There's so many angles to the prism of this movie that I find fascinating. The effect it had on pop culture, that it drove a nostalgia wave for the 50s and 60s.
A decade of sitcoms.
Yeah, that led to sitcoms and led to like spinoffs and all this sort of stuff. Like, this movie is like such an important movie.
And for years, I don't know if it still is, but for years it was the most profitable movie ever made. Because it was made for less than $1 million budget. Universal, who put the film out, had a program to give filmmakers, you know, like $1 million to make a film. And it was made for like $700,000+. And it ended up making over $300 million. So for a while, on a per profit basis, not a gross basis, but a profit base, it was the most profitable movie of all time. It was a huge film. And it's a hangout film. It's a, you know, there's not like a plot. It's just you're spending time with these four guys. Kurt, Steve, John, and Terry, played by Richard Dreyfuss, Ron Howard, Paul LaMatt, and Charles Martin Smith, as they cruise Modesto, California, where George Lucas grew up, on the night before Kurt and Steve are supposed to leave town to go to college.
There's one thing that, like Ron had touched on, that I think is just, is we're all big Star Wars fans, right? I hadn't seen this movie until I was older, in my early 20s or something like that. I'd just never seen it. And I was shocked.
That it was the same guy?
Yeah, that it was so good in the ways that I would not have expected. That to me is always like, if anybody brings up the movie my whole life, what I go is, it's so good. And it, like, with this bit of surprise, because, you know, Star Wars is great, but in a
different way.
1,000% different way.
And that was my thought watching this was, man, it's too bad he didn't make more of these kind of movies.
Totally. Yeah. Or put this into those movies. You know, like find some way to combine. I mean, the only thing, you know, he did.
Ultimately, all this was about driving cars, even Star Wars was.
Sure. Well, no, not that part.
Just the small stories about people. He had such a good grasp on this.
Yeah.
I probably haven't seen this movie in 20 plus years, but it was like, wow, why didn't he make more of these? I mean, I know why, because he was making a money bin sized bin of money for making sci-fi movies, but still, man, he had
that. And he's an impenetrable psyche. Right. I don't understand why he does anything he does.
Yeah. It was funny because I was talking to a coworker, and I mentioned that I watched it. She was a fan of it. And she's like, you know, he's really meant to make small indie films. And I was like, no, he's not. It was like he invented the genre.
Yeah,
exactly. He invented the, and I don't want to make this about Star Wars, but I'm like, he changed cinema with Star Wars in terms of special effects and all this sort of stuff. Like
he's the tent pole. He's the reason that we talk about box office and there are tent pole movies.
Exactly.
And what's interesting is, you know, this movie had a hard road to get made. Like Universal first didn't want to make it and then didn't want to release it after he made it. I mean, the only reason it got made in the first place was because Coppola came on to produce the year after The Godfather. So it immediately got greenlit. And then when they screened it, they were like, fuck this movie. You know, the executives, they didn't want to release it at all. So it almost didn't come out at all. It almost just got put on a shelf. It wasn't guaranteed because it's a hang-up film. It's like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. There isn't a driving plot line. It isn't like Steve needs to get something. It's like they're all just sort of hanging out and doing their own thing for, you know, an hour and a half. And it's not like your normal film.
Yeah, it's that. It's a time movie where it's like you see them when they all get together when the night starts and then it ends the next day. Like, and that's all that happens, you know. Connor, going back to the budget stuff or whatever, but like it just made so much money.
Yeah, ridiculous.
And like they kept on re-releasing it and it kept on making more money. Like they re-released it in 78 with Dolby sound and it made another 60 million. Like it's like.
It kicks off the boomer nostalgia, right? So you know, then, you know, 10 years later, you have The Big Chill, which is sort of the other side of the coin of this story. But like, you know, you have, again, this leads to sitcoms all about the 50s and 60s and Laverne and Shirley and Happy Days and all these things that come out of this movie. Now, Happy Days, the pilot was before the movie, but the pilot didn't get picked up. But then it got picked up after the success of this film. Like, it's all very complicated, but this leads to an entire decade of boomer nostalgia, which is a huge, you know, money-making aspect of it.
What really struck me about that is that this takes place in 1962, and the aesthetic of this is really what I think we would normally, what we used to associate with the 50s.
Yeah, like,
you know, like this isn't what you would think of as the 60s, but this is the end of that.
It's the end of that. That's what's great. But, and it's on the eve. It's like it's on the eve of everything turning to shit.
Well, so we are in 1962, which means that the next year, everything changes.
Yeah.
1963, Kennedy is killed. And that era, that post-war baby boomer era is over.
Yep.
And so this is the last fling before they move to that thing. And Dreyfus, a Jewish New York City kid living in Modesto, is you know, he's the guy who's like, well, should we move on? And like he is representative of the things that come after and he doesn't want to go.
Yeah.
Right.
And he can't decide if he should or not. And by the way, this is a kid who's probably never been on a plane. He takes off in the end. He doesn't even think about it. Anyway, by the way, they drive right onto the tarmac.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's crazy.
Like there's a fence, but then they walk around the fence. I was like, what is going on here?
There's four kids. Kurt, played by Richard Dreyfuss, who is leaving the next day to college. His buddy, Steve, is Ronnie Howard, who like the popular kid at school.
Class president.
His girlfriend is played by Cindy Williams from Laverne and Shirley, and they're sort of breaking up because he's about to go to college. He realizes, I want to bang a lot of people in college.
Well, so also, not only it's Richard Dreyfuss's sister.
Right.
Is Ron Howard's also girlfriend. So there's that relationship.
And Paul LaMatte is the greaser. He's the Fonz character.
Who's older.
The reason why they added the Fonz to the Happy Days was because of Paul LaMatte's character in this movie.
He's Matthew McConaughey.
Charles Martin Smith is Terry, and he's sort of the younger nerd of the group. And so they end up starting together and then splitting off into four different storylines throughout the course of the night.
And then coming back together.
And people like Harrison Ford makes a small appearance, and Wolfman Jack.
Harrison Ford, he's talking with a Fargo accent for some reason.
The thing that I understand is that it takes place in California, but it takes place in Modesto.
Right.
Right? And it takes place, this is
Modesto is east of San Francisco.
No, yeah, east and south of San Francisco, yeah. And like, yeah. And you Central got Valley. Stockton and Central Valley, which was then and is still now a lot of farm,
yep.
And all this sort of stuff. And what had happened was that Lucas grew up there, and there was nothing to do except get cruise. Into hot rods and cruise and drive up and down and drag race and that sort of thing. And so, like, hot you race. Know. Yeah, so it's just like pod racing. So Harrison Ford, who plays Bob Falfa, is, you know, the latest hotshot hot rodder who comes looking to beat the best, who is John Milner. And of course he's going to be he's got a hayseed hat, cowboy hat, and he's got a farmer.
Well, he's got the hat because Harrison Ford didn't want to cut his hair.
Yeah.
That's why he has that.
Some enchanted evening, which is weird, the best. There are two moments in the film that are my favorite, and there's that. It's the scene with Harrison Ford and Cindy Williams awkwardly as he's trying to, like, you know, like.
I just don't understand why she got in that car.
Because she
doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's true. But
it's stupid. You said it though. My favorite moment in the movie is the very beginning when Terry tries to park his scooter,
which is a mistake. It was a mistake, and they left it in the movie.
Well, so
right, it was a mistake, but it told everything you needed to know about that character immediately.
Yep. Well, so here's the thing, is that this movie is filled with so many things like that. My favorite part of the movie is, and I'll tell you why, and it ties right into what you're saying, Josh, is that throughout the movie, the soundtrack is just amazing. It was like one of the first movies that really, like, the had soundtrack no score. Was a character.
Yeah,
no had score. An amazing score. You know, like, it was great, and it was all done in diegetic sound as everyone is listening to Wolfman Jack on the radio.
So the first thing that I say to people is that, A, that movie's amazing. And the second one is, it is my favorite sounding movie of all time. Yeah. Walter Murch, I'd mentioned, I love the way this movie sounds. I spend the whole time just going, oh, listen to that. Because all of the sounds, diegetic means it's the thing that's happening in the world they're in. It's not non-diegetic, which is when, like, the orchestra comes in or John Williams kind of thing. And all the sound is natural, and it's so unusual.
And so what's great is that it's in this time period where, like, all the kids are listening to Wolfman Jack on the radio. And if you don't know about Wolfman Jack, he was a legendary DJ, and there was all these rumors about whether it was a pirate station or not and how it did and stuff like that. It plays into it. George Lucas got Wolfman Jack to do all the talking in between the radio bits and stuff like that. And ultimately, because Richard Dreyfuss's plot line is that he sees a blonde played by Suzanne Somers of Three's Company fame in a white T-bird, and she smiled at him, and he's looking for any excuse to not go to college. And
she says, I love you also.
Yeah, but he's like bemoaning that he hasn't met the love of his life yet, and where is the woman that will wow him, and he thinks it's her. And so the whole night is spent chasing her. And so finally, he in a bit of desperation, he drives to the edge of town to the radio station, thinking that that's where Wolfman Jack is, to try to get a dedication out there. And he meets the engineer in the radio station, who's like, yeah, man, no, Wolfman Jack, he comes in, drops off the tapes, I play him, and blah, blah. But in that scene, when he walks in, Wolfman Jack is eating a popsicle. And the naturalness of this, where he's like, he walks in, and it's like 3 in the morning, and he's like, hey, you want a popsicle? I got the fridge broke. I got a fridge full of them. You want one? And like, and then later on, when they go to shake hands, they shake hands, and Richard Dreyfuss kind of rubs his hands after they shake, and he goes, ah, sticky little buggers, aren't they, these popsicles? Oh, man, I'm going to be eating them all night. And like, this thing that is so realistic and not part of the story natural. At all, but natural, and gives it so much weight and so much depth to it. I just love that entire scene, and it's because of the popsicles.
And that the part of the thing that makes sense that is George Lucas is that he always talks these like experimental films or whatever. And what you're talking about there is extremely experimental for the time. That naturalistic stuff that's taken from French cinema, that is, you know, stuff that American movies didn't do, is to just let you be there in a moment. And, you know, that's the part of George Lucas. That's the guy that he always said he wanted to be. And odd, that's the first thing he had success with and then never revisited it.
Yeah.
Now, I know what you're saying. What I wondered is, did people know when they saw this movie that's what Wolfman Jack looked like? Or was that like, you know, was that like a reveal?
Probably.
Yeah, I think so.
See, he would have been featured in print ads and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Plus, and you could tell his voice was so distinctive even.
Oh, no, I knew it was him because we saw him a lot growing up for whatever reason.
Oh, it was so good.
But, you know, they go on all kind of wacky adventures. Terry meets a girl. He's driving Steve's car around, and that gets all fucked up. And then Kurt gets kidnapped by a gang at one point. And Steve's just desperately trying to break up with Laurie, but also trying to sleep with her. Like, there's all kinds of things happening.
He's a creep, and it's funny because he's not Richie Cunningham.
No.
No.
Like, he's just a doofus.
Yep.
Can I tell you about the one anachronism that I found?
Sure.
The band is playing, and the guy has a Fender Stratocaster, and it has the oversized headstock. which didn't happen until the late 60s. Also, that guitar was beat to shit. And I was like, that guitar was 5 years old most. It just was like, they wouldn't have had time to make the guitar look like that. But immediately I saw that oversized headstock. I was like, nope, that's not till CBS bought them in the 60s. That's impossible.
So there was a lot of things about this film from a history point of view that are important. Like Ron said, it was the first film that without a score, they just had a soundtrack. And it was one of the first films that showed the entire...
Is that true? Really the first one?
It was one of the first ones.
I watched this and I thought Martin Scorsese owes his career to this.
And Tarantino.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first films that showed the entire crew in the credits. Before that, you just get five people in the credits and then the movie would be over. This was one of the first times where they showed the scroll with everybody in it.
Cool.
A lot of experimental stuff. It's a super low budget and they had to... figure stuff out, stuff that didn't work, stuff for various reasons they had to figure out.
What did you think of that scene where Mackenzie Phillips and Milner, they do the shaving cream stuff and there's the gigantic spotlights there?
Yeah, that I was watching with my wife and she pointed that out. But she's like, why are there giant spotlights next to the bank?
I know. It's like, well, maybe they had those in town. I was like, you can't shine giant spotlights down a street at night.
That was weird.
I think that they just went with it, though.
Yeah.
And that dreamy quality of it makes it kind of work. Like you notice it, but it also added that sparkle to the scene that made it seem otherworldly.
Yeah.
How about this, by the way? The relationship between the two of them.
Milner and Mackenzie Phillips. So those who haven't seen, if you've seen the movie, so John Milner is cruising. He's the top dog. He's the Fonz. And he pulls up to a car full of girls and is like, and I guess what would happen at this time period is that people would just hop in each other's cars and cruise with one another. And so he's like, why don't you come over? And the girl's like, I can't come. I'm going steady with somebody. He's like, Judy's sister can go. He's like, well, bring Judy's sister, send them all over. And so Judy's sister pops out and it's a 12-year-old girl played by Mackenzie Phillips.
14, I think.
Doesn't
matter. Young. She's very underage and she seems also, I'm going to get to my point in a second, but she's in a huge t-shirt and jeans. And I was like, there's not a girl in 1962 who'd be wearing a huge t-shirt. That's not how people dress. They didn't wear pants.
The tomboys definitely were.
Girls?
Yeah, for sure.
It was really unusual.
Tomboys definitely did.
Okay. The point being that they managed to do that whole thing, and it wasn't creepy at all.
No.
He was definitely, no point was it weird. And he was like, just be over there. And then at the end, it's like, tell me you like me. He's like, all right, I like you. But it wasn't creepy. It was sweet. And he gives her, a kiss on the cheek.
He pretends to hit on her to get her out of the car.
Yeah.
She won't leave his car. She was like, all right, I'm just explaining. There is a moment where you think he's, okay, now he's going to try to sleep with her, even though she's 13.
It was fairly obvious that he was doing the thing. But at no point are you ever you're never creeped out by it at all.
He's the greaser with a heart of gold. He treats her like a little sister. He protects her.
Yeah, that's laudable.
And I think he was an interesting character. He also realizes his time is running short. Somebody else is going to come along faster than him.
And that's basically what happens is that, so when Harrison Ford and him ultimately do race, Harrison Ford flips his car and loses and the car blows up or whatever. But then Terry and Milner are walking back to the car and Terry is like, oh man, you beat him. You're the best. And, being the loyal nerd. Yeah. And he's like, no man, I was losing.
Yeah.
He's like, up until the point where he fell, I was losing, what I love about that with the Milner character is that, he's older than all them, than these kids. He keeps on calling them kids and he's feeling his age and he's feeling like the end of what he reminisces to other people like, man, it used to be you could cruise all night up and down on a tank of gas. And it was like he was being nostalgic for how the cruise scene was years ago, which I just thought was an interesting angle. But he sees the end of it. And, unfortunately, he doesn't know what's around the corner. And when the movie does end, when Richard Dreyfuss gets on the plane and Ronnie Howard doesn't, which is the reverse from what was going to happen at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
We get the little what happens in the future, Vietnam and all that stuff kind of happens. Terry goes to Vietnam and goes missing in 65. Milner gets killed by a drunk driver in 2 years. Right. They're all very short lifespans. Yeah. And Ronnie Howard.
Hope Cunningham just becomes a local insurance guy.
Never leaving the town. But the unspoken implication for Kurt is that he fled to Canada.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's a writer in Canada. That would, at the time, would have led you to believe he avoided the draft by fleeing to Canada. Objector. No, not even that. That's just was illegal.
I know. But here's the thing. Who cares what happened to any of the women? Because they don't matter.
Well, because it was about the four friends.
I know, but
they were the main characters. Yeah.
And let's talk about Candy Clark, the first manic pixie dream girl.
I found myself really liking the way this film looked, the quality of the color with the film stock. It had that sort of 60s quality to it, very saturated with the color. I thought it was beautifully shot. Sometimes very interesting angles on things. Again, that's why I was like, man, why didn't he do more of these kind of things?
That's the whole thing, is that like my whole come away from this is like, I love Star Wars, but it's just like, oh man, like why couldn't we gotten, but you know, they did a sequel. They did more American Graffiti, which is, you know, like, which is
supposedly really bad. I don't think I've ever seen
it. Yeah.
it's but, supposed to be like one of the worst sequels of all time.
Yeah.
But this type of movie, like it's, I just find it so hard to believe that Lucas was capable of doing this.
You know what I also thought the whole time I was watching this was, it's only 2 years till Richard Dreyfuss does Jaws.
Yeah.
Like, he looks like he's aged 20 years between this movie and that movie.
He does look very young in this. They do a good job of making him. I mean, he still
He's nearly 30 in the movie as an actor, but like just the way he goes from looking young here to being slightly gray-bearded in Jaws.
Ron Howard was the only one who was actually like 19 at the time. Charles Everybody Martin else Smith was. Yeah.
So this led to them deciding, no, we will pick up Happy Days, which opens in the first season with Rock Around the Clock, which this movie opens with. People think that show came out of this movie, and it did in a way, but they'd already shot the pilot. But it's basically a very similar aesthetic. And then Cindy Williams, of course, gets cast in Laverne and Shirley. There's a lot of that.
So, like, Happy Days isn't based on American Graffiti, but they are
But it happened because of it. Yeah,
exactly. Both Connor and I could do a whole nother podcast on Fonzie stories after seeing Henry Winkler speak a couple of years ago. But I love the ABC standards and practices wouldn't let Fonzie on screen in a leather jacket unless the motorcycle was in the shot as well.
Yeah,
because a leather jacket suggested gangs or suggested all these other things. So like that's why when you watch Happy Days, like the motorcycle being in the diner was purely to let Fonzie still wear the jacket, which is just felt like I remember watching as a kid. I'm like, why did he bring the motorcycle in the diner? And like, now it all makes sense.
I'm reading a lot of really terrible stuff in the description of More American Graffiti. This is terrible. This sounds awful.
Lucas didn't make it though.
Bill L. Norton wrote and directed it. Norton.
And then nothing else ever again.
Norton. He made nothing of ever. He made Losing It in 83.
Jeez.
He made a Tom couple Cruise? Of films I've never heard of. But that's just sounds awful. They retconned a bunch of people's storylines and
the people who wrote, didn't they work together on a movie like the Radioland Murders or whatever that
probably
was?
Probably. Lucas produced that one.
Yeah.
He didn't direct that one.
It's just amazing what Star Wars did to Lucas's soul to make it so that he can do these kind of movies again.
It's Anakin and Darth Vader. It's like
it really is. Yeah.
The cost benefit analysis.
And we love Star Wars.
Yeah. You're going to run your Star Wars empire rather than spend 3 years doing a little indie film.
Yeah. The whole thing about this is I just think that like where the net of it is that when you look at 70s cinema and 70s film, especially which is like after reading The Big Goodbye, Connor, and like Chinatown, all this sort of stuff, the evolution Hollywood took through the 70s is really, really fascinating. The idea that the blockbuster film didn't exist, definitely not until Star Wars and Jaws, but actually American Graffiti was like considered one of the first summer blockbuster movies, right? And so this idea that you could drive millions of dollars in box office revenue, it wasn't a thing until like 1972 or three or four or so.
And The Godfather too.
Yeah, The Godfather did it. Yeah, and so it's just its place in film history is important.
Yep.
Again, it goes back to what I said at the top of this, which is that there are so many angles to this film of what it influenced or what role it played. And it's just delightful. I mean, I love Terry's storyline. Like, so Terry the Toad, you know, Steve, Ron Howard's character, says, you know, go to college tomorrow. I want you to take care of my car. And it's just like bitchin' car. And so Terry takes it out and he's trying to be all cool and pick up girls. And he finds a girl who's just like a space cadet, but is awesome. And they have like a crazy night. And it's that whole idea of like that, the crazy night. Right. And it's just like, It's just so much fun. And even Richard Dreyfuss with the Pharaohs, with the gang. This movie works on so many levels. And, you know, you look to films now, but like when we were in college, you know, Can't Hardly Wait, you know, like even most recently Booksmart, like all these films fall under this same genre and they all lead back to American Graffiti.
It's the one night before your life changes, you know, before you leave your friends. And there's a discussion in this movie about why should you go somewhere else and make new friends. You've already got your friends here, but that's what everyone has to go through, and that's what all those movies are about ultimately, is you're leaving behind your childhood to become an adult.
Yeah,
that's what half of America didn't do.
Ooh.
I'm reading this now, Ron, and the writers of this film, along with Lucas, they also wrote Radioland Murders and Howard the Duck.
I knew it.
And Temple of Doom and a bunch of other things.
It totally makes sense. But even like the John Hughes movies owe this, right?
Yeah.
Like Ferris Bueller's Day Off is this just during the day. Dazed and Confused is a direct line to this.
Yep. It starts a genre of the last night of high school.
Well, the teenager, you know, wasn't really like, this is the era that like birthed the teenager too. And people don't really understand that prior to World War II, like the idea of a teenager wasn't a thing. It was afterwards when, in the 50s, when there was, you know, relative affluence and time, that like there was something known as a teenager.
You could cruise the strip instead of working the farm.
Yeah.
You know, you were able to spend all night cruising around in your fucking awesome cars instead of getting up early to work the cows, because you had to before then. Now that there was prosperity, you could do that.
Depending on who you were.
Yeah, of course. The cars were great. The music was great. The aesthetic around it was awesome. And this, of course, led to the Mel's Diner chain that you see in Southern California.
And San Francisco.
And San Francisco, that didn't exist. Mel's Diner was a real diner that Lucas would go to, and it went out of business before the movie. And then, of course, the success of the movie meant the kids of the owner opened up a chain of restaurants, Mel's Diner chain.
That's really interesting. I was wondering about that.
The waitresses on roller skates. And I did love in this recent watching, like, so I've seen it in less than 20 years, but I hadn't seen it, probably haven't watched it for at least 10 years or so. I didn't realize that like everybody was kind of after the waitress at Mel's, like that Buddha.
Yeah.
Terry was trying to ask her out. And then when Steve and Lori broke up and Steve was kind of like, you know, pouting in his milkshake, Buddha comes over. He's like, why don't you come over after I get off? And like, it's like, oh, what's going on here? there's so many layers to this movie, and it's just so personable and so relatable, and it's real. It's real. That's the thing.
Well, at the same time, it's not the sitcom kind of American Graffiti one. No. It is much more realistic, for lack of a better word. The characters in it aren't all like perfect, you know, like you see, it's funny because you see, I want to call him Opie Cunningham because I heard it once and it makes me laugh every time, but you see Opie Cunningham and you think, well, he's the good, it was Eddie Murphy.
Yep.
You see him and you think, oh, that he's the good guy. And he's like, no, he's not. Like, he's just a regular sort of dude who's trying to see who he can sleep with. You know, he's not
awful.
He
actually might have the least amount of screen time, actually, of all of them.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. You know, Harrison Ford is charming as hell in it, in the very little time he has. You recognize faces. Like, the head of the gang, the Pharaohs, was a face I recognized.
Yep.
Lindsay picked out Kathleen Quinlan.
Kathleen Quinlan is there.
Which then she goes on to do Apollo 13, directed by Opie Cunningham.
Yeah.
Suzanne Somers.
Right. And very briefly seen in the movie.
Yeah. This was really Mackenzie Phillips's kind of breakout, too, as a teen.
She was amazing.
Yeah. She's great. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was good. I'm glad we all liked it. It was a really nice little film. And I don't say that as a derogatory term, but it was a nice little film.
Yeah.
In the best way.
When they go to the sock hop, when they go to the freshman dance at high school, which is so like going, like you're going forward by going backward, like kind of thing. Lame. But and Richard Dreyfuss strolls out and meets up with the teacher and is having a cigarette outside, and like it's clearly the teacher is sleeping with students. Right?
Yeah. Super creepy.
Really knocked up a student.
You know what though?
Yeah.
It really was presented in such a way that was more modern than anything else. Talking to this guy and he's kind of cool, and then he goes and does something just like ugh.
Yep.
And I don't know if I'm putting a modern spin on that, but I don't think I am. It didn't seem like it was an acceptable thing. Even just him going out and having a cigarette with him is like jarring now. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah. There's a lot going on that one night in Modesto. Mm-hmm. A lot of things happening.
Bo Hopkins, was the actor who played Joe from the Pharaohs, the lead of the gang. Yeah.
Hey, those are multicultural gang too, by the way. It was like,
he was
white. Give him that. They were Latino.
Again, that's the region. That was true to the region. Yeah.
There was actually a non-white actor in this. He was a criminal, but he wasn't a guy in brown makeup. So it's something.
Yeah. And this was supposed to be Paul LaMatt. Milliner was a breakout from this as well. Everyone thought he was going to be a huge star. And he had he had a pretty decent career, but it didn't really break out as much as that.
What did Paul LaMatt do after this?
Not much. I mean, he did a lot.
I kept expecting every time I watched it, I'd be like, what happened to that dude? And you're like, oh, not a lot.
He has worked a lot, but nothing.
He worked a lot, but nothing. He did a lot of TV movies and TV series and miniseries, a lot of TV work.
Murder, She Wrote, Twilight Zone.
He was on Lonesome Dove for a while.
TV actor.
The series.
Yeah. He was in American History X.
Yeah. That's about it. Grace Under Fire. Yeah, so I really liked watching it. I thought it was terrific. I mean, I've seen it before, but I hadn't really sat down and watched it thoroughly in a review kind of way, and it was really fun.
Cool. I'm glad you guys liked it. Glad that was my pick. So who's picking the next movie?
Who's picking the next old men on old movies?
Yeah.
We'll figure that out. It's a monthly show, so we'll do it a couple times.
Yeah, we should do it quarterly. I'm down with that.
Once a quarter?
I don't know if Josh is into it, but after reading Big Goodbye, I'm planning a Chinatown watch. So that would, you know, that could keep it the same 70s theme, but by no means do I need to force it on you guys. So.
Lindsay watched that a couple of months ago, and I watched like half of it with her. Like I came in and she'd been watching it.
I have not seen it since like I was a teenager. So I'm excited to watch it. More adult, you know, more learned eyes, as it were.
Well, when we decide the next time we're going to do an old man and old movies, we'll let you know ahead of time, usually on the Pick of the Week show, which is our weekly comics show that Josh and I review comics. We have our bi-monthly Booksploded and Talksplode shows. Ron has All About Android, which comes out weekly somehow.
Tuesdays.
Somehow there's enough to talk about with phones.
So much. We have to cut things.
So those are all the shows. We'll be back next month with more Media Explode, and we'll let you know next time we're going to talk about an old movie. And until then, I am Connor.
I'm Ron.
That would make me Josh.
Get in your hot rod, Josh, and go.
Just go.
Like I'm not relating to Terry the Toad more than anyone's. At least at that age. When the clock strikes 12, we'll go.